wanted to send you, maybe I'll try to resend that. It's a Workman working in front of the 21 foot diameter gold mirror, and that kind of, it just gives you a better perspective of the size. Now, everybody knows what 21 feet is, but guys, he's on a man lift in front of this thing. You could really tell this is going to be a monster. Yeah, the shade itself is that's going to protect the telescope from the heat. It's the size of a tennis court, so it's pretty massive. And the price, last time I heard, about a week or two ago, I used to say $8 billion. I've been saying that for years, but now I read it's $10 billion. Time has gone by. I guess there's been more money allocated to this thing. So I was kind of surprised to see that. So, yeah, oh well. More vitamins. Or at least keep you. Take them on time. That's the hard part, trying to remember. Another thing I wanted to talk about is the next launches of cargo ship up to the International Space Station by SpaceX on a Falcon 9. Drop it. That's going to occur August 13th. But there's been a big delay, like 39 days without a flight out of Florida, and that's because the range actually building a lot of infrastructure, things that are involved with communicating with satellites, and not a lot of computers, a couple of weeks to do that. So it takes this time to stand down in Florida, but that's going to change again real soon. August 13th, SpaceX is going to send up a CRS-12, another Dragon cargo vehicle to the space station, over 7,000 pounds of stuff going to it. So that will be the last brand new cargo vehicle that SpaceX sends up. Not going to be reusable. In fact, the last one, CRS number 11, went up. That was the second one for that spacecraft. That was originally went up. It was CRS number 4. It had its storage. They rebuilt it. New heat shield and all. But pretty much the original spacecraft. This WS2N, and what they did is set it up last time. Now this one here, number 12, is going to be the last brand new one, and the rest of them that go up with the next flight itself are all going to be re-dragons that have flown before. You know, these dragons come back on parachutes, and they land in the water, and they're the only ones that bring equipment back from the space station. The Soyuz brings people back, but this thing brings equipment and science, experiments back to the scientists. So they always planned on reusing this. I remember in the beginning NASA said, only brand new ones, that's it. But now, you know, they've changed their tune so that they're reliable. So not only is the SpaceX reusing the first stage, they come back and they either land on land or they land on a barge, but now they're reusing their Dragon spacecraft. They also have another contract with NASA for another 10 or so flights after the contract is up. So for that, they're building a brand new cargo vehicle, cargo version number 2, I guess you would call it. So that will be capable of bringing heavier loads up and still be able to come back and land on the water, and maybe even on land with parachutes. But the idea for now, anyway, of propulsive landing, they plan on eventually putting rockets inside the spacecraft itself, these Super Draco engines, they're called, and 8 of them mounted in the spacecraft. But then, they're going to take a broom, add a lot of weight, and they're not going to do that this time. Those engines will be installed on the crew vehicles, because they're going to be used for possible emergencies. So, in other words, if the rocket blows up on the pad or in flight on the way up to orbit, the Draco engines will fire and pull the spacecraft away from the engine. So we should start to see manned flights probably by the end of this year, definitely sometime next year. Now, you know, might see an unmanned flight at the end of this year, and maybe the first manned flight, maybe a couple of months into 2018. Surprised it's hot that one out. So, yeah, SpaceX is doing a lot. They have a flight coming up at the end of the year, probably in December. The Falcon Heavy, that's where you take the three Falcon 9 boosters and bolt them all together and launch them at one time. So you have 27 engines going off at one time. Not a record. Rush tried that with the N1 rocket. That was their version of the moon rocket. They tried that four different times. Wound up all failures. They all exploded or had problems. Blew up on a pad. So as far as being successful, they never did it. They tried it. They had 30 engines. Different configuration. That was what SpaceX has, but it didn't work out. Let me drop it. One other flight that took off last week was by a company called Vector. Vector, they plan on launching small rockets in space. And their goal is to bring up 300-500 pound payloads. And if they did get one off the ground last week, and time it was from a place we talked about a couple of months ago called Camden, Georgia. It's on the East Coast, crossed by Atlantic Ocean. Been plans on launching from that location for decades. This guy is actually taking it to heart. He ran his first test out in the desert a month or so ago, and that worked out. And this one now from the East Coast, from Georgia. We'll eventually have another launch pad there. This was a suborbital flight. Rockets aren't powerful enough to get to orbit, but it's, you know, something of a milestone. I guess you would definitely consider another launch facility, another milestone. This is WS-20. A couple other topics, Dick, but pretty much got to the end for now. Just want to talk about New Horizon. We talk about that on January 1st, 2019, about the Kuiper Belt object, KBO, that investigating, taking pictures of, and sending it back to Earth another year, and roughly a year and a half from now. But that's pretty much it. This has been WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Dick.
New Horizon, as I remember, is a spacecraft that did a flyby of Pluto, a planet that's not a planet anymore, recorded lots of pictures. It's so darn far away, the spacecraft, that it had to send the data very slowly to have enough narrow bandwidth of the receiver. And I think it took almost a year and a half or so to send all the data back down. I am guessing the New Horizons has given us all the data it recorded, or almost all of it, and I guess I haven't been keeping track of New Horizons. It is now about to, in the next year or two, fly by another object in the Kuiper Belt, close enough in the other object that it's going to get visible pictures of that what's going on, as well as measuring magnetic fields and solar wind and whatever. So what New Horizons is going to be doing in the next few years, Paul? I only heard portions of what you said because I got called away for a minute. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, New Horizons. It's been, I guess, 2015. July 4th is when they went past Pluto. And you're right, it took 16 months to get all the data back from that encounter. Pluto has now five moons. It's got pictures of everything. It's, you know, planet, the moon, all the data is in. And, you know, the Deep Space Network was working forever to try to do this because, you know, they have to split up the time between other other spacecraft that are either at Mars or at Saturn, such as Cassini. By the way, that's coming to an end in September. That's going to be, that's going to dive bomb into the atmosphere of Saturn. And Cassini's been up there in orbit 2004. But New Horizon, yeah, they planned on going to a Kuiper Belt object, and they're going to intersect on January 1st, 2019. Wanted to find out more information about this. It was discovered a couple of years ago by Hubble. They searched the heavens in the direction of New Horizons because they wanted another goal, another mission for New Horizon after it left Pluto. So they got the funding for it. And now they know where they're going. Let me try this. Called 2014 MU69. So 2014 is when it was discovered. MU69. Kuiper Belt object. Probably around 30 miles in diameter. Well, that's what they thought originally. But now they were able to do some occultation events. A couple of them where this rock would go in front of a star and the distance. By doing that, they could get a better idea of the size. And it looks like it might be a double asteroid, either very close together or maybe slightly stuck together. So maybe it'll be pretty interesting to view this. This will be the furthest object that's ever been photographed in the solar system. Yeah, even Voyager didn't do that. Voyager went as far as Neptune, and never even got to Pluto. So that's the story on that New Horizons. So it's still ticking along. They have the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators on board, a couple of them. So of course they don't need solar power and quite well. Back to you next.
I wonder how New Horizons funding is going along. In the case of Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, there is a YouTube video you can find now on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 where they interview the people that are still on the project. Some of those people that was launched in 1977, that was what? It's going on 40 years ago. And a number of the people are no longer alive, no longer on the project. The project itself has been relocated. I think the receiving site, so to speak, where they process all the data, I think it was part of the Goddard Space Flight Center, or is it the Pasadena, California Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Wherever their original site was, they got displaced. Other things are higher in priority, and they got shoved off into, I think, first. I think they're operating now out of something that's a little bit better than a motel, so to speak. So the staff on the Voyager still getting data, still processing it, but the funding is decreasing. The plushness of their atmosphere is decreasing. Storing all of their data is a little bit of a problem, and so you can tell that project is kind of winding down. The amount of power they're getting out of the radioactive thermal generator is decreasing. They have to turn off more and more things. Like in one particular case, they mentioned the fact that they didn't have enough power to turn on a heater at the same time they ran a particular experiment. So what they did instead was to generate a little bit of local heat by using the motor of the physical tape recorder. Running the motor of the tape recorder to generate heat wasn't as big a drain as the real heater, so that the particular experiment would work correctly. It wouldn't be completely frozen at the time, so they're having to juggle the amount of available power very carefully. So I'm amazed. Here we are 40 years downrange. Let me drop this. That the consumable gases to run the thrusting jets hasn't run out of fuel. That thing is still able to aim itself to the nearest tenth of a degree when it is a 1 degree antenna at Earth, to the nearest tenth of a degree. I'm rounding off the numbers. Still has the ability to aim use that accurately 40 years downrange. That, I think it's a 10 or a 12 foot diameter dish running at 8.5 gigahertz. Good news is the dish has got the 40 some odd dB of gain. I think it's 45 dB of gain. But if that dish is not precisely aimed at Earth, all that gain goes down the tubes and you don't hear anything. So that spacecraft can still precisely aim itself 40 years downrange. That's got to be some kind of a record. That can't be an inertial wheel because the inertial wheels on, say, Hubble never lasted more than, what, 5 or 8 years or so. So when you find that particular YouTube video, lots of information is there about Voyager 1 and 2, and they show you a picture and interview, so to speak, each of the people that are still on the project. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I don't know if they can give a Nobel Peace Prize out to a guy that worked on this thing his whole life. It's one fellow, Ed Stone, project manager. He was there from the beginning. He says he raised his family, kids, grandkids, you know, and still at it. But once in a while, he'll give an interview. Ed Stone, whatever award you can give somebody, you should get that one. Wow. And as far as their location, it was always Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They got thrown out of there. Sometimes they get put into these colleges. Some of the colleges, like Arizona, I know Arizona State is involved with different missions. Maybe they wound up in a college. I don't know that. I'll have to look for that. Very good. One other mission I neglected to mention is there's a company, Orbital ATK. They're the ones that usually launch rockets out of Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. They're getting ready to launch a rocket out of Florida now. It's Nova Launch Complex 46. And it's going to be a Minotaur rocket, one of the solid booster rockets. I think it's got four segments to it, and then the fifth is an additional one. You get this particular satellite, perfect inclination, zero inclination around the equator. But it's not.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This particular satellite's only going up around 350 or 400 miles. But in a perfect equatorial orbit, the idea of the satellite, they call it sensor satellite, SENSOR, sensor sat. It's going to be looking out away from the Earth with all these high-pollute cameras that are top secret, by the way. You can't get a picture of this thing. And it's going to be taking pictures of all the satellites in geosynchronous orbit, and they're looking for debris, things that might be broken, satellites that are not operating properly. So I thought that was an interesting satellite that's going to be going up. You just don't hear about it. That'll be going up in, I believe that's probably, I think that was August as well, the end of August, 28th or something. Back in there.
I'm going to go back for a second to the previous subject. Let's see, I pressed the button here. There I am. And all the people they interviewed on the Voyager program, what was it? I can't think of his name. Ed Stone. Roger, Dodger, Ed Stone. Ed Stone was definitely interviewed. You see a picture of him. He's looking good. Each of these guys are being shown in their present location where they've been moved to. I think you're right. I think it's a college is where they're now located. They have to be housed somewhere to collect all their data and interface with each other. So I think Ed Stone has been on more than one project. But I guess he has spent more time on Voyager than any other. Is that approximately what happened, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW?
I'm sure he was on something else, but he was, definitely involved with Voyager from the beginning. So, I know he probably had his hands in the Mariner missions to Mars and to Venus, I'm sure. And then So maybe he was the project manager, maybe he was one of the workers or something. You know, he, like anything else, you work the way up and he became project manager of Voyager, Voyager 1 and 2.
What's unique about Voyager is that it had a reasonable-sized launching vehicle, nothing huge. But they had encountered, they planned on, they claimed after they launched they discovered this, I'm having trouble believing that, but they discovered that there was an extremely desirable alignment, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They did a sort of a flyby of almost every one of those planets, picked up a whole lot of extra velocity on each individual flyby. That gave them a huge amount of velocity when they got all the way out there beyond Neptune. That by ordinary rocket power, they would never get that kind of velocity. And that desirable alignment of all those planets is something that happens, I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's something like once every 100 years. You have to wait almost 100 years for that desirable alignment to happen again. And nowhere near big enough are any of the launching vehicles, even the Bigelow, even the Elon Musk vehicles are not anywhere near big enough to give you the kinds of velocities that Voyager has. So Voyager is at a very far distance, at a very high velocity, and so I think you and I can easily gamble that in our lifetime, nothing is going to exceed the speed, distance, property of Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 because of that very desirable planetary alignment. You remember once every 100 years or so you get that. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think they said 125 or 170. Well, I don't remember, but it was, yeah, just over 100. Particular alignment happened. Some guy, really good with math, engineer type guy, he was involved with the early investigation. What they wanted to do with Voyager. Actually, Voyager had another name before Voyager. I forget what they were going to call it. They were going to call it, it was going to be called Viking, even so the Viking mission planned up going to Mars. But it had another name, and this guy investigated the alignment of the planets, and he was the one that said that, you know, we could use the gravity assist of all these different planets, and the gravity assist was never done before, and he was getting, you know, an extra 8,000 miles, you know, from Jupiter, and another, you know, 6,000 miles from Saturn, and he did all the math and brought it into powers to be, and he was one that convinced them. They called it the Grand Tour, I think it was the Grand Tour, if I got the name right. But Pluto, they were thinking about Pluto. But what happened was they would have had to have a slightly different trajectory, so more interested in that called Titan, clouded over, kind of like Venus. Really wanted to get it close and see what that looked like. So Voyager 1, they said, let's make a slight adjustment. But to do that, they had to come in to the south pole of Saturn, actually, to Titan. By doing that, that put its trajectory off. That's why that's the diagram of where these all these satellites are. You know, you have Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 also that left the solar system, along with Voyager 2. They're still along the ecliptic plane, which I'm saying. But Voyager 1, because it came to the south pole of Titan, that was the only way they could do what they wanted to do by getting a close look at that. Wound up going up on a little over 30 degree angle away from ecliptic plane. So right, as of now, that's actually above the ecliptic plane looking down to the north part of the ecliptic plane. So they gambled and they kind of lost. They didn't get the pictures. It was too clouded over. They didn't get what they wanted from Titan. So years later, I believe it was February 14, 1990, they had Carl Sagan talk to them and turn the cameras around. Let me drop it. And taking a series of pictures in a planet, and the outer planet, couldn't get Mercury, and they couldn't get, I don't think they could get Venus, but they got the Earth and all the other planets. That way, you know, it's just one little dot. Carl Sagan named one of his books The Pale Blue Dot. So, because, you know, Voyager 1 went into that kind of an angle, it was able to look down and take all these pictures, series of pictures looking down at the solar system. The only shot like that. After that, they turned the cameras off and never needed them ever again. Back to you there, WS2S.
Yeah, that picture of the planet, it's got to be carefully pointed out to you what you're looking at. To think that with it being out of the plane of the ecliptic and high up, you're getting a nice top-down view of the solar system. As a diagram on paper, it would look nice. In reality, the size of the planets and the distance between them, for real scale, are tiny, tiny little points of light in a great big field of blackness. Except for the sun, there's not much there to look at. So, yeah, you can point to a dot and you can say that that is Earth. But you certainly, from those distances, are not going to resolve anything in where you can really see. I don't even think you can see that it's blue. You're certainly not going to see the difference between oceans and land. I vaguely remember that picture was, the concept is exciting, but the picture itself, I think, is not very exciting. It's just tiny little dots on a black background. Is that what you remember, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, naturally, you can get that on the internet, but I have the picture itself from the book, The Pale Blue Dot. Was published in that, so it, you know, naturally it's high resolution as far as the picture goes. I'm not looking at the internet, and you can tell it is a blue dot. And the theory goes, you know, it's Carl Sagan, you know, he's filled with philosophy. You know, anything that's ever happened in the world, all the past wars, dinosaurs that walking around the earth, and all the things that happened in the future, everything that went on happened on that one little tiny dot, you know. That's really why he wanted to do that. He liked all that philosophy back then.
When it comes to exciting pictures, the latest issue of QST Magazine, which I think arrived, I think I'm talking about the August issue. I might be talking about the September, the July issue. The latest one that I got, near the front end of the magazine, is a beautiful picture looking up a guy's tower, and you see his tri-band Yagi and a couple of other antennas on top of the tower, and you see the moon in the background, and the moon fills up about half the diameter of the picture, and it's called a snapshot of his tower with the moon in the background. Go through the mathematics of that. To make the moon fill up a 3/4 of the picture, you had to be using something like a 300-millimeter lens. Use a 300-millimeter lens when you're standing on the bottom of your tower with your head on the ground and the camera in front of you. And use a 300-millimeter lens, you're going to see a small fraction of the antenna on top of your tower. So what I'm saying is that you go through the mathematics, that picture has to be a composite. He's got a picture of the moon, he's got a picture of his tower and his antenna, and he printed one on top of the other. That cannot be one single snapshot picture with any reasonable lens, unless he can mount the lens 500 feet below ground and make the ground transparent. He's not going to get that picture. If you get a chance, take a look at that in front and take a careful look at that picture at the latest issue of QST if you get that, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
I thought the same thing when I saw that picture. How in the world does this guy take this picture? The whole antenna takes up the whole moon, you know? So, you gave a little bit more thought. Apparently, it's a composite. But, you know, it is good. I mean, did he take that picture the same night? Or is that just any old picture of the moon? And he put the antenna in afterwards? I don't know. But I agree. And I was thinking, well, maybe it was on the horizon. You know how a moon always tends to look a little bit bigger, but that's impossible because you're looking at the bottom of the antenna, so that couldn't be. Unless the antenna was laying down. I was thinking maybe it was laying down, and the moon's in the horizon, and he got like a, you know, 1,000 feet behind it and took the pictures, but of course, that's not possible. I thought the same thing. Back to you.
Yeah, that effect where you see the moon as a larger object when it's on the horizon, that is a psychological effect. You take a picture of the moon on the horizon, you take a picture of the moon at high noon, so to speak, and then you measure the diameters in those pictures, and they are the same. The moon does not get bigger on the horizon, even though your brain thinks it is. But he's looking up his tower, so he's, in fact, where he lives, you and I could question whether or not the moon ever gets that high in latitude to be behind his antenna like that. The antenna is shown as a silhouette. So when you're doing a composite printing, you first print the moon and then print the antenna on top of it. The way a negative into a positive works is that any dark object can make a portion of the printed picture blacker. So therefore you can make the tower and the antenna show up. Well, does the moon get that high in his latitude is the first question I would ask. How many millimeter lens makes the moon that big? And with his tower, with a 300 millimeter lens, you would never see the bottom, the middle, the top of the tower in his antenna like that. So it's got to be a composite. And it might not even be the same day, if you know what I mean. It's a good looking picture. They call it a snapshot. And that's not a simple snapshot. Over you, Paul. KQI, that is.
Yeah, what does the moon go up? About 80 degrees or so here, maybe it's highest. And if you got under your tower, you're up, what, 100 feet or something. That would only be, what, I think the moon is a half a degree. You were looking up at your, well, I don't know if you have an, I don't think you have an HF antenna up there. But if you had an H, let's say you had a 20 meter beam, how many degrees that would that be sticking out? Probably 10 degrees or more, right?
You got it, Paul. The antenna would be 10 degrees, and the moon is only half a degree. The moon is exactly half a degree. And that's going to be very important on August 21 during that full eclipse, which I wish you and I could go and see it, but it's not easy. But, so, a 10-degree antenna, a half-a-degree moon, you've got a picture where both of them are approximately the same size. That would only exist if he is a quarter of a mile away from his antenna with a telephoto lens. So, there's a whole lot of things about that picture that can't possibly be real. The moon's orbit is tilted 9 degrees compared to our ecliptic. I think it's 9 degrees. And I have 40 degrees north of the equator, 40 minus 9. I think the moon cannot get any closer than 30 degrees from straight overhead. So in other words, the moon can get about 60 degrees above the horizon. If I got the mathematics right, I don't think it can get any higher than that. So depending on where he lives, unless he's living in Florida, I think that picture is, again, not possible. Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. You know, you talked about that eclipse. You know, everything I've heard so far that you wouldn't be able to see anything in New York, but yet Newsday printed something, a few days ago, saying that they'll be able to see 70% of the sun will be able to, you know, will be halted by the moon. What have you read that thing? So that means, you know, we get to see something here. I'll break up my wobbling lens. I'll have no problem. Back to you, Dick.
I got a question. WHCC.
Andy recognized. Yeah, there's a couple of articles saying be careful about a welding lens. The welding lens does a beautiful job for welding protection of your eye. But depending on the brand name and which welding lens you're talking about, it might not have enough infrared filtering. The real power of the sun is infrared. The infrared roaring through that filter, in the worst case scenario, could potentially do eye damage. Now, yes, the moon is only going to be covering the sun 70%, where you and I live, 72%, something like that. So you would say, hey, I'm going to see 70% of the excitement of a good total eclipse. No way. The real total eclipse, if you're within that, I think it's a 9-mile radius, where the umbra of the shadow, the center of the shadow, goes right where you're standing, and the sun gets thoroughly blocked, and the sky becomes so dark you see the planets and you see the stars at nighttime. Let me drop. The birds stop chirping because they're getting ready for nighttime. The crickets stop. The crickets start chirping because they think it is nighttime, and you see the stars. So the total impact you get from the total eclipse is 100 times bigger than what you and I are going to see, Paul, unfortunately. And during that total eclipse, the sunset on the horizon, so to speak, but the horizon is in all, that sunset, so to speak, is in all directions at once, and you're in the middle of this very dark area. I don't know the exact number, but if somebody told me the amount of light output goes down by 5 f-stops, I'd believe it. To B2CDL, K2RIW, go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, good evening, Dick and Paul. I just thought I'd ask you a question. It's on a space subject, so that's why I'm asking. I just happened to have glanced where your program on TV. I wasn't really watching it because I was distracted. I was doing something else, and I saw it in the background. But I did look up a few times, and they were talking about, and I believe it was the Mission Control Center. I don't know if you mentioned this before, because I just turned the radio on. I think it was Mission Control doing the Apollo moon landing, I think. I wasn't paying 100% attention because I was this interview on TV. The bottom line is that they said that the command center is still there, and the equipment, the consoles, the TVs and everything is still there, but it's been abandoned, of course. It's not used. And they were talking about resurrecting it, and they were interviewing some guy about he was actually there doing the mission, and I forgot the guy's name. They said that they want to resurrect it and get it working again as a model to show what it was like. They even mentioned. Let me just let it drop. Stand by.
By the way, Andy, I was there, Building 30 in Houston. But that's another story. Back to you, Andy.
All right, I figured you were there. I think I saw you waving. So I don't know if you brought this up before, but it was interesting because they say they want to resurrect it and they want to get it as a working model again. And they're actually showing pieces of it that have been literally stolen as souvenirs over the years. Little push button switches and pilot lights and, you know, other things on the console that are no longer there because they were taken as souvenirs because of this mission that occurred, or missions. Did you see this article? It was on TV. I don't know what, I think it was on Channel 2. It was in the evening. So I just thought I'd mention that. Go ahead, Dick.
You got a ball.
I've been down to Florida, in four Johnson Space Center, and visiting the control center. They still kept the control center from the early flights, from Alan Shepard, Chris Carpenter, Girard, and Cooper. You know, the early flights, Glenn, of course. So I don't know if they changed it from the late 1970s when I was there. It's like a museum. But in Texas, yeah, I guess they didn't make it a museum. You're going to have people walking around if it's abandoned with itchy fingers, and they're going to take things. So they're going to probably bring it back to life and just show people the way it used to look. If you look at the new Mission Control, you can see that every time you Thanks, Rob. You know, in Houston, they have massive LCD screens out that are up of, on a wall. They're always 24 hours a day working with the International Space Station. Everything, you know, there's something always going on with that massive room. In fact, Mike Pence just went on a tour a month or so ago of that facility. He's now in charge of the space operations. Brought that system back again where the vice president is always involved with NASA. Went on a tour, and it was pretty good if you watch that. It's much bigger than the old, than the room that they used to have for mission control. But I didn't see that, so I guess it must have been a, you know, was on PBS or was it a news article maybe, Andy? Back to Dick Burke.
Yeah, how long ago did you see this program? I think you said it was on Channel 2, Andy. At nighttime, was it part of a news program? Think now. Are we coming by one of the dates of the Apollo mission? You know, the 30th anniversary, the 40th anniversary type stuff. So, what was it? How long ago did you see it, Andy? Go ahead.
Let me get the beep because the ID came on. Alright, it was this past week. Today's Sunday, I think, I'm pretty sure that after last Sunday, today. I really have to think back because it was not something that I tuned in, and I believe it was Channel 2 because basically it's the only channel I watch. But you know what? I guess if I do an internet search or just put in some keywords, I bet you it'll pop up when this article. It was an interview. They were interviewing one of the guys who actually operated Mission Control. He was there doing the event. I don't know if it's an anniversary coming up. I don't think so. I think they were just, you know, they just wanted to resurrect this, the command center, and again, you know, unfortunately I was distracted because I was in the middle of a project, so I was like watching this in the background, and I was interested in this article on TV, but I couldn't stop what I was doing. So I'll have to look it up, but I thought maybe you saw it, any of you guys. I guess you didn't. We'll have to look it up and find out more about it. And it was interesting, though, because they showed the console with all the push buttons and the old CRT picture tubes and everything and everything else. So it was pretty good. Dick?
Yeah, nowadays the controllers for things like Spirit and Opportunity and Curiosity, they do an awful lot of their work on laptops. Personal CRT monitoring stations are not used. After Apollo 15, which was the summer of 1971, where I got 3 hours or so of reception of the astronauts, I managed to get an invite to Houston. My contact down there walked me around Building 30, the main control center, during a quiet time. This is in between Apollo 15, but months before Apollo 16 was going to be launched. And they brought me into Building 30, which is the main control center in Houston. One of the paper maps that was on one of those zoo desks, which showed a partial map of the moon near where the landing took place. My escort picked up that map and handed it to me. That's one of the souvenirs I got. I managed to see some of the astronauts in training for later missions. I got a chance to sit on the lunar rover car, the model of the lunar rover car that was at Houston, which had rubber wheels, and the rubber on the wheels was mostly worn out because so many guests had and ridden around in the car. I was allowed to sit on the car, but didn't move while I was on it. Let me drop this. And at another time, which I think was, yes, much, much earlier, if I remember correctly, I was at Kennedy Space Center, and my my escort there was a guy named Charlie Bell, who worked for NASA, ham radio operator, and I was buying a antenna, Scientific Atlanta antenna pedestal from him at the time, so that's why I was down there, pick up the pedestal and ship it home on an international harvester truck that I had borrowed from a friend, and he took me to launch pad 39A, there like 6 o'clock at night. Noah, while we were up on the middle of launch pad 39A, the guard came along and launched and locked the gate at the bottom of the launch pad. So he had to get on the telephone, the emergency telephone, to get them to unlock the gate. Otherwise, we were going to have to climb over some barbed wire to get out of launch pad 39. So for about a half hour period of time, I was locked into launch pad 39. Over to you, Andy. WA2. Oh, by the way, I've got a question for Andy and anybody else who's listening. Let me drop this.
Do me a favor. I'll be back 11:30. I gotta go. I'm leaving right now. I'm turning the radio off. I'll be back 11:30. We'll continue. WA2.
Okay. Do you know of a website that'll give me a television schedule for Long Island Television over the air?
If you're asking me, no, I don't.
Okay, thank you. Maybe Eric does. So from Newsday, I can find out what's going on over the air television, but Newsday doesn't cover Channel 21-3, for instance, World, and there's a lot of good programming on there. So I know there's a website somewhere that allows you to get local over-the-air programming. So,
Did you with it?
Go right ahead, Dave.
Yeah, the site I use is Titan, like the Titan rocket, Titan TV. That'll give you sorts of choices that you can choose for which channel lineup you want to.
Let me have a repeat on that. Now, Titan TV is at www.titan.tv. Over to you, Dave.
No, Dick, it's Titan, like the Titan rocket. T-I-T-A-N. Titan. Search on Titan TV site. You have a couple of choices. You know, you register, you know, with an account. It's all free. Set up the channel lineup, you know, that you want. You can choose over-the-air broadcast city, you can Connecticut, you can choose Philadelphia. You know, there's all sorts of choices that you can pick.
As far as the information is concerned, Dave, I thank you and it sounds good. But you said you might have to register to get all the info. That scares me. I went to one of these sites with something very desirable sounding. I registered with my email address. As a result of that, every single day, I get 85 pieces of spam. Even though I've got a spam filter, which helps a lot, my junk file is being filled up 85 pieces of junk mail, spam, per day, every day of the week. It's a bit annoying. Unfortunately, I gave them my favorite mail address, which is on my website. A whole lot of people who know me by that particular email address.
Yeah, Dick.
Apparently, the only way I can stop this is to abandon that email address, and that's going to be painful. Over to you, Dave.
Yeah, you don't have to register, but when you register, what happens is, remember your preferences, you know, they signed up for. If you don't register, what happens is every time that you go to the site, now you have to make your choices all over again. That may take minutes to pick it from the menu. But if you register and sign in, remember you, every time that you log back into the site, it automatically comes up with preferences that you have chosen in the past.
Okay, Dave, did you register? And are you getting spam because of it? I'm a little bit worried that if I register again, I'm going to double the amount of spam I'm getting. That's what I'm a little worried about. Over to you, Dave.
Yes, I've been registered with them for a number of years. And as far as whether or not I'm getting spam as a result of that, I don't know. How would I know? You know, when you get spam, it doesn't tell you that you got your address from website ABC.
Out of curiosity, Dave, roughly how many pieces of spam per day do you get?
No, in a day I'd probably get 5 and 10.
You are a lucky guy. I apparently went to the best spam manufacturer in the world by mistake. They were offering something very desirable sounding, like a drawing for a laptop computer or something like that. They were asking quite a bit of information. I naively gave it to them. And boy, have I been getting spam for the last year and a half. Said 85 pieces on the average day. Now, so from what you know, I guess maybe what Andy was telling us, and maybe you can confirm this one, Paul, are they thinking of taking building number 30, the main command center of Houston for the Apollo program? Are they thinking of stiffing it up and making it a tourist attraction? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I don't see how they can. You know, isn't that part of other offices and things that are involved? That building is still used for other purposes, isn't it, Dick? You were there. I don't think they could isolate that. That would be the problem. See, the blockhouse out in Florida, you know, for launch, you know, the early launches, that's what it was, the blockhouse. You could actually go in there, and that's it. It has no other purpose. Especially nowadays with security and everything, I don't see that happening. But I really don't know.
As far as 1971, which is what 46 years ago, when I was there, I vaguely remember it as a three-story building. The building looked to me like it occupied about an acre, and I think the actual control center in Building 30 was on the second floor. That's my recollection. Second floor of Building 30, and I think it's a three-story building, but as I said, this is a pretty vague recollection of 40 years downrange. Over to you, Paul.
No, then they won't use it. I can see them, you know, actually building another building, small building somewhere, and taking the equipment that's not used anymore and setting it up in there and just saying this is the way it was. You know, basically changing the location, I don't think that would be a problem. That would be good. Yeah, I was going to say something about that Channel 21, World, I think it's called World Channel 21. This year, about a week or so ago, they had a very good show on there. I don't know if you saw it. A couple of years old already, but it was a two-hour special. Or a two-hour documentary about the Higgs boson, really about CERN and all the people that were involved with the Large Hadron Collider, all the scientists. Peter Higgs was there and took you through that 20-year journey when it started until probably 2013 or so. Back to you.
That's a very well-done documentary. It's called Particle Fever, 2 hours. I saw it again night before last at 3 o'clock in the morning, from 3 to 5 or 2 to 4, something like that. 2 in the morning to 4 in the morning on 21-3 World. Very well done program. And great difficulty. They discovered that the Higgs boson requires something like 125 to 126 giga electron volts of acceleration to make it show up at that energy level. And it's a rather small bump, and they've got reasonably high confidence they found it, but they're still gathering data to make sure. And it's halfway between the two extremes of, had it been a lower number, we would have had a symmetric universe, and if it was a higher number, we would have a much more random universe, a multiverse. So it's halfway between the two. So, it didn't fall where they expected it to. And like you said, a very well done program. Back to you, Paul, K2RIW. By the way, let me drop.
Yeah, now I know what Sigma 5 means.
Yeah, when it comes to confidence level of something that you gather as statistical data, the standard deviation represents the upper and lower point of one sigma. Two standard deviations is called two sigma and so on. So when you go to the upper and lower tail, of the I may have it backwards. But five sigma is very high confidence. What they're really saying is that they're absolutely sure that the data that they found with, 99.99% probability, this is the real number, plus or minus a little bit of error on it. But it's the right ballpark. They found the right ballpark. And they think they're very close to home plate. How about you, Paul? KQRIW.
Yeah, I think Sigma 5, they said, was a 10 million to 1 possibility. You know, it's just outrageous odds that it would be wrong. But what they said was it went up to 145, and then it would be, like you said, the multiverse. But the lower number, 114 or so, then they would be looking for supersymmetry. The end result was it was in, like you said, in between. But now they're happy about it because they could look for all these other new particles. If the number was 145, you know, those particles might exist, but they might be outside the universe, they said. But yeah, very good show. That was Particle Fever. Saw that. And very well done. Interviews with all the people and, you know, really talked about the magnets, the cryogenics, how things broke with the helium leak, and did a good job. If anybody gets a chance to see that, you can see that on Netflix, by the way, I found out. But I don't get Netflix, but if you do, you can bring up Particle Fever and death. 2 hours well spent. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I am guessing there are a number of websites that will give you portions of Particle Fever as a YouTube video. There was a presentation at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, which used to be called the New Community Center, Cinema Center or something like that, now called Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. Roughly 1 year ago today, they had a presentation about Particle Fever while I think they were in production of that movie, so to speak, and they had a live interview with somebody at CERN played during this afternoon presentation, and they announced that the people who have got good questions from the audience will get a prize, and I tried to ask a good sounding question, I don't know what the hell it was, and they gave me one of the prizes. I think they had about 8 of them. Yep. Stereographic viewing cardboard device with a picture of that 5-story high Alice detector. It's a nice thing to look through with a man standing in front of the picture so you get a size comparison. So I received that as a prize from going to that presentation. And I guess it was about the creation of the movie Particle Fever. Let me drop. Kind of interesting, at the end of that movie Particle Fever, somebody from the audience asked her, how can I earn a dollar at this? What good is it? To which the scientist being interviewed basically said, haven't the vaguest idea, but roughly 100 years ago, they had invented something that we now call radio, and nobody thought that would ever have any value. In fact, in the very early days of radio, before they had invented the idea of broadcast, thought it would be a system for sending messages back and forth. In fact, Alexander Graham Bell said that if you're running a business, you might want to use a telephone to send ordering information. But who in the world would ever want to put one of these in their home? That was Alexander Graham Bell's attitude about the telephone. Boy, did he have an unlisted number. So, radio in the beginning, you didn't have the vaguest idea. Did it have any value? So the Higgs boson, what it is, how heavy it is, how you get to view it, how it ties in to our understanding of subatomic particles. Guaranteed someday in the future somebody will find a great way of applying that knowledge. You never know how new information, as long as it turns out to be truthful, accurate, you never have the biggest idea what it's going to become. Guaranteed someday that's going to become a useful product of some kind. WS2N, KQRIW.
Time with a comment. Somebody who has comments. Yeah, look at quantum mechanics and everything. And they use it for quantum computers. Somebody with a comment, Dick.
Go right ahead, comment. Please identify yourself.